Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour Podcast alongside Chris Rosenthal. I am Kevin Brown for Inside Lacrosse. Rosie, we are down to the Final Four, going headed to Salt Lake City, PLL semifinals. The Boston Cannons and the Denver Outlaws advance past Minnesota weekend in the quarterfinal round. It was a doozy. Two great games. Not much more you could ask for in terms of exciting finishes. Rock fights. You got a lot more offense in the first game than the second, of course. But Rosie, how you feeling first off? And second off, how'd you like the quarterfinal round?
Man, always emotional seeing the teams, you know, have put all the blood, sweat, and tears into it for a full summer. I understand the dreams are not going to come true this time around, but that is the nature of the beast, right? That is why they play those games. And eliminations are always tough, always sad to hear those guys afterwards. But, you know, it makes it just so much sweeter when you do win it, I suppose.
Rosie, you love elimination games, but you hate eliminations indeed. Friend of the pod, Rob Pinnell, what could have been his final game in a professional setting, just a good effort from him, just a really lackluster Maryland Whipsnakes offense, indicative of the whole summer in fold for them. We'll get to that. The Denver Outlaws win was the first on the docket. They defeated the California Redwoods 15-14, staving off the comeback attempt. A lot of late penalties they give up, but the core four, the Torton Quartet, returns in full effect. Jared Bernhardt ices it in effect with that lefty goal past a Justin Anderson screen with Dante Bowen back there. Cole Kastner can't catch up. The lefty strike, and it's 15-13. Malloy, his fourth goal, makes it a one-goal game, throws it away when just really great pressure from the Denver Outlaws to force that. But just a game of runs, classic playoff lacrosse. Two incredible goals in there from you think I would say Jake Taylor, but playoff wise there there's two goals where Dalton Young lays out Chris Fake, leads to a quick Brennan O'Neill goal, and I was like, wow, that is playoff cross. Logan McNaney tries to take it out of the crease way too many times in the second half. Brian Tevlin gets a second bite at the apple and just lays it into the open net. Two really flunky, cool postseason goals that you see in September. Rosie, what should we take away from this Denver win? Back to somewhat full health, back to, you know, McNaney and net saving some good shots in the defense, coming up clutch when it matters most.
Yeah, you know, this was the offense that I think, you know, Outlaws fans or supporters or believers, you know, definitely assumed would, you know, finally show up when the time was right. They get all the people back, firing all cylinders. Personally, I wanted to see it before I believed it, and I will say I was convinced. You know, we saw the speed from Jared Bernhardt. You know, that was a good question. You know, how close to 100% would he be? He looked pretty good turning those corners and beating guys off the, you know, first step. Saw Pat Cavanaugh, you know, handling the offense, you know, dishing and distributing. Big role from him. I think, you know, Dalton Young, like you mentioned, big sort of a stepping up in the playoffs. We've obviously seen him throughout the season, you know, filling in, doing some attack, things like that. But I think getting back to last year, one time when he really kind of saw his stock rise even more than in progressively risen throughout the year was come the postseason time. So, you know, I guess once again, we're going to see a playoff Dalton Young and everybody else seem to elevate their game as well.
It was incredible. So you're back. You're back on the Denver Outlaws. It's been three podcasts since I titled the title game collision course cancellation between the Water Dogs and Outlaws for myself. The two most talented teams on paper. The title game collision course, of course, was canceled because of all the injuries with the Denver Outlaws. But Rosie, you're back. You've seen them all back in this game, and you're like, all right, you only got to beat Utah at home, and then you're playing for a title game.
Well, I never said the path to get there was easy, right? But, you know, you see the vision, right? You see what people were saying, well, just wait and see. Finally, we're seeing it. You know, this is the team that they thought they would have. You know, you heard Tim Sedan throughout the season saying, you know, like, you know, Brennan will be back. These guys will be back, you know, if not out of the lineup back, you know, back at full strength kind of back. And yeah, they did produce, managed to kind of spread the wealth around. Everyone kind of elevated their game at the right time so far. Now, we will see as far as, you know, the penalties. I think that was a big sort of thing. Almost losing this game is certainly going to be, I guess, a wake-up call for them. But yeah, they looked pretty good. If you want to go buy some Outlaw stock, try to hop back in on that. You know, it's going to cost you a little bit more than when you sold it, perhaps. But, you know, I wouldn't blame you for buying so.
I know more than most, the title game collision course may very well be back on with the performance that we saw there. To your point about the late penalties, that indirect hit to the head on T.D. Erlin off the faceoff wing from Jack Gray really set things up for Dylan Malloy to hit two in a row. And then next thing you know, it's a close game again, and the Outlaws were like, uh-oh, this could be bad. And they're shooting themselves in the foot a little bit. But when you add Jake Taylor to the lineup, you have the innate chemistry with Pat Cavanaugh and Notre Dame connection. You saw the tweener. You saw the fading BTB. This is just what he does. And he creates space for himself and more significantly others, like the Luke Weirman step down was laughable. Poor Chris Conlon getting caught on the Jay Taylor corner there. And man, the all-around pieces for Denver look a lot better now that they have a full complement. The big news came when Jay Taylor was... He kept his spot in the lineup to the much to the dismay of rookie Evan Plunkett, the fourth overall pick. Tim Sudan trades three selections, really two picks, because it's a first round swap, plus two picks for Evan Plunkett's services. You know, he hasn't had the summer that you'd expect. And then you pick up Jay Taylor off the three-game waiver rule. Rosie, were you surprised to see Plunkett dropped in favor of maybe other veterans and Jay Taylor's kind of different dimensions?
No, I think just based on the, you know, lack of productivity that we've seen from Plunkett, you know, I guess there comes to be a certain point where, you know, and good for Tim Sudan, right? He, you know, obviously put his name behind that move. And anytime you're going to trade, you know, make some trades, kind of a, you know, one that's not necessarily balanced as far as draft picks go and something like that, you know, you're really kind of putting your name out there. And good for him for being able to say, you know what, hey, maybe this didn't work exactly like I thought. Let me go ahead and switch things up. I'll punt on this real quick because, you know, there's no room for mistakes anymore. So, you know, maybe we got something better here. So he didn't, you know, stick to Plunkett in there just for the sake of, you know, I don't want to look wrong, or, you know, I could have sworn this was going to work or anything like that. And, you know, maybe it'll work some other time. But, when you got to go right now and you've got Jake Taylor sitting there who's kind of demonstrated, you know, that he's still capable of doing what you thought he was going to do when you bring him on board, you know, I guess you kind of keep it rolling with that. And you certainly want to see him working together with Kavanaugh again. So, you know, if you want to base it just on that, as I'm sure went into consideration, and it worked out well for him. I think it was a strong pitch deciding to keep him on board.
Good game from the Tourton quartet in total. Brennan O'Neill, 3 goals and a rough shooting season for himself. Nice hat trick. Pat Kavanaugh, 2 goals, 4 assists. Logan Wisnowskis has been really the consistent performer all summer long and only had 1 shot that he did not convert. So in Jared Bernhardt, we brought up at those 2 darts sprinting towards the goal, 1 righty, 1 lefty, top side, the lefty to seal it, really. So good showing from them. We're going to hit both winners real quick. Not real quick, but first, and then we'll do our little in memoriam segment for the Woods and the Whips. So Boston Cannons, man, like, first off, we'll get to this more in full with the semifinal previews in the second half of the show, but these two wins really set up the best 2 matchups possible in Salt Lake City. Like, the storylines are not too few and far in between, because Jay Taylor, to go up against the Utah Archers is not a storyline. But if he wins, you know, he could certainly face his old team and a coach who he flipped from at the collegiate level. A former Denver commit goes to Notre Dame. Bill Tierney says he can't get away from me now during draft night, and lets him get away.
Right. Turns out he could.
Because he drafts a lot more dynamic Dodgers the next go-around. That's very, very interesting. The whole Tom Shriver, Captain America returns back to Salt Lake City, the place where, you know, he suffered multiple injuries the last 2 regular season finales, is just kind of like, as a Game of Thrones fan to the side, like, this just like a side quest that, like, you haven't really heard of it, like, heard much from this character in maybe a season and a half. And all of a sudden, he's here to save the day. So it is very cool. And there's more that we'll get into. But Boston Cannons 9, Maryland Whipsnakes 7. Joey Spallina gets a last-second 2-point attempt off that J.C. Higginbottom up to the task. Seals the deal. Coulter Maxey just inside roll, dunking on Matt Dunn. Nice BTB earlier in the game. He had a BTB and a righty rollback. Like, Coulter Maxey was on one. Marcus Holman almost had one of the goal, like, probably would have been the goal of the playoffs with that lefty wrap around with one hand. Just too sloppy from the Whipsnakes. And the Cannons get it done. They get it done 9-7. It's a rock fight. You know, we were maybe clouded with our guest interview last week, as one could expect. No bias in the Inside Lacrosse circles, except when we get a friend of the pod to come on. So we'll hit on Rob Pinnell in a second, but Rosie, give us your Boston Cannons victory takeaways first.
I mean, so first things first, if you're talking about the winners, shout out to the Poles, right? Close defense, strong performance, held these Whipsnakes largely quiet. Joey Spallina, like you mentioned, getting that 2-pointer attempt off, but no turnovers in the first 2 matchups against the Cannons in his career, and 4 in this game alone. You know, clogging the passing lanes, some of those were thanks to the Poles, some of them thanks to the shorties, but it's the point nonetheless. Just, you know, kind of locking down that whole close attack. You know, TJ Malone largely quiet. Rob Pinnell had 1-1. But then, of course, you bring in Ethan Rawl to the conversation as well. Just a stellar performance by all of those polls. Let's make sure we get ahead of this right now. What can we do as a society to make sure we are properly rating Ethan Rawl at all times? So, like, 8 years from now, we're not saying he is an underrated player. Can we just say he's really good right now? Is that fair? Is that going out on a limb, or can we just give him those flowers immediately?
He was everywhere. So many ground balls, so many calls, turnovers. What was it, 7-4 he ended up with? The final stats I have right here. Don't you worry. 7-3. All right, 7-3, 7 ground balls, 3 calls, turnovers. One just kind of laid into his lap a little bit with Aiden Carroll just hitting the turf monster in that second half. Just really indicative of the Maryland Lipstick struggles.
And a goal.
Ethan Rawl getting in on the scoring fun. It was a good game from Ethan Rawl for sure. I think it's him and Jared Connors in the LSM of the Year conversation. I don't know who else would you put in that conversation for the end of season awards. If you're listening to this, I believe the PLL has announced their PLL end of season award nominees. The final is coming out Wednesday, September 2nd, to be unveiled before the title game. So any other LSMs you're putting in that category?
Well, I think it's going to be both of them, and then I think they'll give Jake Pacino the opportunity to run it back and defend his title with another nomination as well. But, you know, maybe they do three, maybe somebody else hops in there, but I wouldn't be surprised to see those three, definitely.
Yeah, I think you're right. Jake Pacino, I think, has had a solid season, does what he does best in transition, and from all accounts, it looked like California was going right at him. And when you're part of the game plan that, like, listen, we can't go let Terry. Ryan Tarafenko is that good that if we need to get Jake Parcello involved, like, that is not good news when you got Tom Schreiber coming back from injury, possibly well-rested. Well, definitely well-rested, but we'll see how fully healthy he is. I'm getting ahead of myself here. The Boston Cannons put together quite the defensive display, to your point, Rosie, and they're just probably the best well-matched, which is funny saying this after the Loyola game where it looked like they were just in absolute shambles for the Maryland Whipsnakes offense, with Will Donovan going down to close and Jack Kielty on Spallina, and Owen Grant is just an absolute monster. You saw Rob Pinnell get that lefty goal when he finally got off Grant onto Donovan, doing a little triple rocker into the five-hole bouncer. Had a nice question mark look down the stretch. And, you know, if you put that bottom left, it's probably going on JC, but he goes top shelf. JC matches sticks. So it was a just very impressive game, considering, you know, their defensive midfield's not really their strong suit. So they probably needed more from Matt Brandau, who I think obviously wasn't healthy with that big brace on. Adam Poitras was asked to do maybe a little too much. And when you're putting the pole on Aiden Carroll, we saw he had that nice little strip behind the net too. A great defensive performance from Boston that they'll carry into the semifinals.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the story of the season, you know, just kind of continued rearing its head during this one, which was, can you get consistent offensive production from the Whipsnakes? You know, we've seen the droughts, we've seen, you know, certain guys going silent at different times. And, you know, it's been something they've attempted to address throughout the year, tinkered with the lineup a little bit here and there, as far as, you know, say, taking one person out, putting one person in, like, But ultimately, they didn't find the right combination, right? They didn't unlock whatever it was that was prohibiting them from having a full game of offensive production. And, finishing off with 7 goals, just kind of a symbol of that whole thing.
Let's get into it. The Rob Pinnell final game discussion. Of course, it was way too early for him to say for himself if it indeed was his last game. But to Ryan Boyles and everyone else who's really covered the game, you got to give him his flowers if it is. So just all-time career professional field lacrosse points leader, inspired generations of quarterback attackmen with the question mark, patented move, and such a two-handed facilitator and dodger. And just the way he played was probably a little more taxing on his body than maybe a Marcus Holman, who's still playing at the peak of his powers, playing off ball and playing, more so off really other elite dodgers and shooting from the outside. Rob Pinnell, just to my point about, taking that question mark ready shot down the stretch there, I really thought back to his answer last week when he brought up that 2015 Lizards title game, and he's like, yeah, it's a game I think back to often. It's a 4-goal, 1-assist Rob Pinnell vintage display that he did not let the game get away from him after, losing the Canada, the World Championship, getting silver there, losing the Syracuse in 2009 National Championship. These are games that stick with these legends of the game. So, it was, to your point, really tough to see him so emotional post-game, and You'd wish his teammates around him played better, to make such an occasion a little more riveting and exciting of a finish, or just put up more than 7 goals. But I don't know. What was your takeaway from either Rob Pinnell's post-game emotions or just a career as a whole?
I guess we'll have to take him for his word that as of right now, exactly, he doesn't know if he's coming back or, what the future holds. It's one of those things that's like, I'm sure it's really tough to have it completely nailed down one way or another. It's also a thing that, I guess you got to ask, it would be strange not to ask, hey, do you know what your plans are? Even though, in all likelihood, he's not going to tell you, even if he does kind of know. And, I think he also doesn't want to let that moment kind of help push him one way or another, right? Like if he was thinking about leaving, but then he was, devastated after the game. Maybe he's, being an extremely competitive person. Maybe he's like, no, forget that. I'm actually coming back. I'm going to do this again. Smart play, kind of sit on it for a while. Totally get that. I don't know. It's tough. We'll have to see. If that was the end, then, one of just, I guess, the greatest careers. I don't know if we will ever see another 300 goal, 300 assist player. Like, there's nobody close to knocking on that door right now. Like not even close to being in that neighborhood. Not at all. Just the unique sort of ability to do both so well is something that, as much as he's known for, I guess it's a pure quarterbacking sort of thing. If you can do both things so well and for so long. So those are things that would kind of stick with me with just what he's been able to do. And another thing I think about as far as the Rob Pinnell career goes is, we spend a lot of time getting caught up in the discussion with, who's going to be the face of the sport, right? That's a lot that goes into it, a lot of kind of lightning in a bottle with various different elements that have to come together at the right time, which is why it's so difficult and impossible. And some sports get one every, 30 years, and some get one or none, who knows, right? But part of it is wanting to or willing to participate in that kind of stuff, right? And he was someone who, as focused as he was on his craft, or as it has been on his craft, he's also been someone who's been willing to, you know, kind of do the other stuff that I know some athletes just want to lower their heads and play, right? But he's been willing to do the interviews, to do commercials, to do all sorts of things that we see from other sports' biggest stars. So that we don't really get much of in the lacrosse space. You kind of have to want to be willing to do that kind of stuff if you are sort of willing to embrace the role as a face of your sport. So I think he's done a lot for the sport, kind of advancing it, helping, you know, just kind of the image of pro lacrosse. And yeah, that's the end. He will definitely get flowers from everyone who, you know, has the ability to give him some flowers. And if not, then he'll come back for another year. And, you know, I certainly think if that's the case, he comes back, he's certainly going to go down swinging. We've seen that just by his competitive nature.
A lot more reflective in his later years, and when he's talking to us and in others and interviews, he just seemed a lot more measured and taking it all in is the last few years of professional lacrosse. And if he does have more in the tank, that will be very impressive. I'm in between whether it's, you know, he's just fighting so many hamstring issues, and whether his body won't let him continue, or whether his drive to not end on a note where he's not ending on his own terms. It'll be interesting to see where he goes from here. So like we said, for all he's done for pro lacrosse in general, it's been tremendous to follow. And again, those are the emotional post-game scenes that just the sport needs when you get to this stage of the season. This is September. Only one team could advance. And Rosie, we do have other free agents to talk about as we enter the off season for half the league here. Of course, we'll check back on InsideLacrosse.com as Rosie and I will get into some Atlas chaos and more off-season primers. But for now, let's stick to the teams that bowed out at this stage, Rosie, and starting with the Whip Snakes and where they go from here.
Yeah, so generally the teams usually around this time have about 8 people or so who have, you know, their contracts still kind of flying up around the air. Maybe they come back, maybe they don't. 5 to kind of keep an eye on as far as the Whip Snakes go: Mikey Boehm, Colin Heacock, Tim Muller, Matt Dunn, and Joe Nardella. So, you know, you just look at that list. Heacock kind of started out the year pretty strong. He's actually having one of his better, I guess, one of his best PLL seasons started it off. Maybe byproduct of his role in the offense, and maybe, you know, running out of gas or whatnot, didn't quite finish as strong offensively. So does he get re-signed with the Whip Snakes? Does he want to keep playing? You know, it's a little bit different of a team now. Is he going to, you know, join his old teammate Matt Rambo? Maybe not on that franchise anymore. We'll see what happens with him. Mikey Boehm, brought on during the season. You know, I think he had kind of an immediate impact. I guess it's between him and Jim Stagnita if they see him fitting in the future. Who else we got here? Muller and Dunn. I think it's just a matter of, you know, do they want to keep playing or not, right? Like, some guys reach a certain point, and that's the big question. Do you want to come back? What's your schedule looking like? You know, the off-field commitments obviously change the older you get. Are you going to want to come back again? I would not assume. I mean, especially a game like this, hold the cans to 9. I don't think Jim Stagnita is necessarily thinking, okay, let me start with close defense and work my way, you know, across the wall.
Need those two back. Need those two back.
Yeah. And then Nardella, I guess it's largely a matter of health. And, you know, if he feels like he can produce as well, they bring him back. So, I don't know. We'll see. So if you're Jim Stagnita, what are you thinking about those 5 guys there? You mentioned Muller and Dunn. You need them back.
Yeah, to your point, like they're the heart of the defense. Tim Mueller just matches up against Marcus Holman so well every time, it seems like. He's the communicator, organizer of the defense. And, you know, that's the part of the field that they excelled in most this season. Matt Dunn, of course, Coulter Maxey is a tough matchup. So I poke some fun at him. You know, the defensive player of the year, reigning award winner, is, I'm sure, going to be determined to come back strong alongside Tim Mueller. Retirement would be surprising to me for Dunn in particular, and maybe less so for Mueller, but he's so important to that defense, and I'm sure that they're going to try to convince him to come back. Joe Nardella, those ACL injuries are no joke. He's had a long trend of them. But he's determined to make his way back onto the PLL field. And talking to him closer to when he got injured, he is definitely eager, and they need him, because you saw just the different guys that they were throwing out there the second half of the season, if any at all, showed just that. So it all comes down to offense. How much cap space are you going to try to save up to upgrade that end of the field, especially if RP3 is hanging it up? And if not, then you have to find a way to be a lot more dynamic around him. And if that's sliding Aiden Carroll down the attack, or, you know, Matt Brando on a healthy leg could be a better dodging option. But you need guys that are just more dynamic down there and able to get that defense rotating, because when push comes to shove, playoff time, and you're not beating your guys one-on-one, then it's tough to win any PLL game.
Absolutely. One other thing, I think, if we're talking about spots they might look to improve or something like that, what do you think Jim's dad, Nita, takes the old Brinks truck and sends it over to Ryan Tarafenko this offseason? Do you think Stags will attempt to, either successfully or unsuccessfully, grab himself a franchise short stick D middy, so he doesn't have to kind of worry about juggling that position, bringing in the rookies like he did this season? He's got to at least ask, right?
Oh, man, I love that we're at this stage of PLL lore where we can just gush over the short stick defensive midfield position like this. But Ryan Tarafenko is a talent that you have to consider it, right? Like, to your point, like, he is worth it. He has probably surpassed Danny Logan the past two seasons as the league's foremost short stick defensive midfielder, obviously, maybe a little better in transition, on par, on ball. And when you aptly point out that they had four rookies starting all season, and, you know, Christian Mazur comes in for the last couple of games and plays really well, we'll see what his commitments are going forward. But that's not a bad shout. I think there's more glamorous offensive targets that Whipsnakes fans will hope for, but Ryan Tarafenko, I think, can excite.
Yeah. If they make one move and they're like, hey, good news, fans, we brought in a short stick defensive midfielder, I think a lot of fans might be like, you know, we just scored 7 goals. You know, maybe maybe something on that side too.
Right.
We'll see. That being said, Terry's gonna get paid this offseason. So we will see who does it.
How about for the Redwoods? Set us up for what their offseason is looking like.
California Redwoods, give you 6 names here. I got a pair of Dillons for you. Dylan Malloy, Dylan Ward, T.D. Erlin, Aiden Denenza, Jared Connors, and friend of the pod, though we have not seen him in a while, Josh Barcasel. Speaking of paid. I think he's probably due for some sort of reward for his efforts as well. But yeah, let's who do you want to start with out of that group?
Well, let's start with Mr. Belcourcel himself. He's, I think, emblematic of the entire group that there's probably not a market for really most of those guys on the seven other teams are not calling Joe Spleen up and asking him not to sign those guys, because there's the Redwoods are such a castaway land compared to the rest of the league that they take pride in it, and we're only a couple goals away from the semis here, of course, the last couple seasons, but like they're talented, but I don't know if any, like the Whipsnakes maybe could use some more midfield initiation with Belcourcel and Danenza, sure. I don't think those are the two guys that they want to exactly target. And the Dylan Ward and Dylan Malloy feel like they're in this Redwoods team till they're not. And I don't know what team is really going to stamp their mark on the Dylan Malloy bulldozing Buffalo style that he has, where he just is not looking to pass ever. And just like maybe the chaos, the whole performance seemed like a big chaos offense where they just didn't feel like passing it at all. And not that Steven Brooks likes that, but they were getting them all summer long that they couldn't get any assists going. So that's where my head goes. I think if the Redwoods don't re-sign them, then it'll be the chaos or a Whipsnakes that might pick up one or two of those guys.
Yeah, you know, especially at the attack and goalie position, there's so few available spots that it's oftentimes out of like really, really necessity, like we saw at the Atlas this season, where you keep trying to figure out someone else who can help you get out of this spiral, right? So is Dylan Malloy somebody who you bring in because you just need one more person to complete what you think is, you know, almost a perfect attack or something like that, right? You know, you might be looking for someone a bit more complimentary. And unless some sort of 180 has been undergone this past season, he seemed to really enjoy that fit with the Redwoods, the locker room culture of the Redwoods, you know, working with Joe Spallina finally after all those years that Spallina wanted him on the team. So, you know, unless that's all been shaken up due to some sort of clubhouse disaster or something like that, I'm inclined to think they both want to be back. And, you know, the goalie spot, I don't know how they're going to approach that in a, you know, a contract extension sort of thing. Maybe they just say, you know, hey, we're going to have Kraddick get the start of the number one. And maybe Ward finds himself in a, you know, I guess a battle once again, or sort of relegated to a support and leadership role on the sideline. I don't know if that's something he'd be super cool with at this point, but being a goalie, I don't know how many choices you have. There's not really that many spots ever floating around for a starter in the league. Right. So he might just kind of, if he wants to keep playing in a capacity, it might end up being just more of a supportive role if Coach Kelly wants to give Kraddick the ball full time moving forward.
And that's what it was headed towards all season. And when you have that first half performance, you let in those goals and you get pulled again. And, you know, I'm sure he wants to play in the Olympics for Team Canada. But when you got a guy like Red Dobson and an up-and-comer at the U21 level, MVP Grayson Manning, All-American at Denver, coming off the ranks, like, that's going to be tough. And you look at the goalie caliber around the league, it's tough to keep a spot for too long if you're not saving 55% and up. So that before we get to solve any of those off-season questions, Rosie, we get to preview these semifinal matchups, which are two amazing matchups. I mean, Boston, Philadelphia, we've got just the matchup rivalry, physicality, grit versus flash, storylines galore in that one. And then Denver, Utah, we got plenty of Brennan O'Neill and the return of Tom Schreiber, just two superstars of the game headlining that one. So, Rosie, which one should we start with? Should we go in chronological order as the Western Conference again kicks this one off?
Sure. Let's do that way.
Labor Day Monday, the action gets underway, 3 p.m. Eastern from Zions Bank Stadium, Salt Lake City, Utah. Rosie, excited to announce I'll be in attendance for these games. First time going all the way to Salt Lake City. Ooh, baby, I'm excited to get to this action. You know, I'm going to be sneaking around, you know, trying to get out to these open practices. They're not going to be open, but I'm going to just draw a little open sign and put it on the fence and be like, Chris Bates, it was right there. I saw the sign. So,
we'll be out there. No one will be more welcoming to pull back the curtain and share his secrets than notoriously public figure Chris Bates.
Oh, yes. I'm looking forward to it. The questions that he has to solve for against this Denver Outlaws, offense and defense. You know, thankfully he's got two of the best assistants in the league with Tony Resch and his defensive track record and pro lacrosse history, and Brian Kavanaugh doing what he does best in the film room and sub box and intangibles and whatnot. But Batesy, you know, that offense has had over a month off, and you know, they finished the regular season with the best score differential, and they're coming up against a defense that, you know, a little hobbling coming in, but looked pretty good for long stretches against that Redwoods offense when they were 6-on-6. So, Rosie, what are you looking forward to in this matchup?
So, there's a ton of things I'm looking forward to. I think the big one that kicks things off is what's going to happen with Brennan O'Neill returning to that crowd that loves to boo him. And how is he going to respond? Is he going to put up a big scoring game, or is he going to be silenced? We've seen both against this team. We've recently seen him silenced, but you know, we'd recently seen him silenced against the Redwoods, and you saw how that went this past weekend as well. So very excited to see what he does in that kind of atmosphere. Always excited to see what these Utah fans do. I love so much. Nothing at all against Brennan O'Neill, but I do very much love that they hate him.
Let's touch on why they hate him first. Because of that.
Because he you know, beat the tar out of their entire team that one time. And that's like, it's a beautiful thing in sports. I love that they have organically decided, hey, we are just going to collectively hate this guy. And it's a fun sort of tradition, you know? And that's what, you know, when you have home cities and all that stuff, you hope that eventually you get tradition and culture. And if one of those things is harmlessly booing at a guy every time he touches the ball, it's a beautiful thing. So I'm excited to see what they do. Excited to see how O'Neill functions. If he has, you know, another referred to as a playoff Brennan sort of performance, switching, turning into the Hulk, or whatever you want to call it. A much, much smaller thing I'm very curious to see heading into this game. Luke Wehrman, if he wins the draw, and we saw this a great deal this past weekend when they're playing against the Redwoods, very quick face-off wins, very quick shots, right?
Possession shots. So much, though, that the one shot.
Yes. The ref said, hey, man, you know what? We're sick of your crap. That doesn't count as a shot. Ball's going the other way. And he was very upset. He was offended. How dare you? That was a shot. It was a terrible shot. So the question is, like, does that leash restart for the next game? Or are they just going to say, look, if we're not going to have this four times in a row with this guy, we're just going to start right away? I really want to see how that affects his play, like, right out the gate heading into this game.
sort of a resurgent season for Mike Sisselberger as well, and it's a tight matchup. That was comical. Oh my goodness. I'm excited to see that as well. I do think the leash restarts, but only for like two shots instead of four in a row. And if it's as egregious as the one that was called not a shot, that was just a blatant possession shot before he got to the 2-point arc, then feel free to just send it the other way. I love it. I love it. Good gamesmanship here in the postseason. The big thing for Brendan O'Neill to watch out for, of course, is Brendan Lavelle coming up against Chris Feek. Big heavyweight matchup in the quarterfinals. He's got another one here in the semifinals. Two really good physical lumbering righty close defenseman who can match up really well against his strengths. And, you know, he had that really nice inside roll that he yanks it with that huge overhand release into the bottom corner in the first half that made me think, all right, he's ready to take it to him. Not too much. Of course, he had a hat trick, so it's a very solid day, but that was the play that really stood out for me. Of course, he had the other goal on the ride. How crazy do you think this is, Rosie? You know, you got Jake Taylor playing so well off others into this offense. And, you know, you got Pat Cavanaugh quarterbacking things again. I think Brendan O'Neill should be the one coming out of the box. Now, I think this is... I've called for it earlier this season in terms of like their interchangeability come postseason time is going to be what takes them over the top. And if they can interchange Wisnowskis, O'Neill, and Bernhardt coming out of the box with Taylor and Pat Cavanaugh staying in attack, that's their best scenario. If you can get Brendan O'Neill coming downhill at short sticks, then you're in good shape. All right, like even if whoever's the Archers LSM, whichever one is out there at the time, like you're gonna have a hard time. And even if it's Brendan Lavelle trying to bump up, like he's much more comfortable in a close defensive role. So I would like to see a lot more Brendan O'Neill coming out of the box as opposed to Bernhardt or, you know, Wisnowskis going straight to the crease.
Yeah, I think that's a great call. I think the thing about Brendan O'Neill is if you send him out of the box, there is always that chance that there's going to be some degree of disarray, right? Like, you know, maybe there's a pick where, you know, if the whole matchup is, you know, Lavelle on him at all times, there is the chance that somebody else happens to, you know, slip out through a pick or something like that while focusing on O'Neill coming out through the box. A little tiny bit of chaos, you know, maybe just 2 or 3 seconds each possession he's out there, but it's something you won't get at all when he is purely playing attack and they can just walk around, stand right next to him the whole time. So it definitely shakes things up, keeps them on their toes a little bit.
What do you think? So obviously it's the four Tuareton winners against the four short stick defensive midfield roster construction for these 19-man rosters that Chris Bates has rolled out all season long. You know, they take away one less offensive midfielder. We'll see if I assume that's going to continue. They'll just have to make a tough decision with who they sub Tom Schreiber out for, but they can always play three defensive midfielders. We shall see. In terms of the Archers offense that hasn't played in over a month, Sam King, you know, has a very solid bounce back, in my opinion, season where he stepped up in key moments for them. Stepped up for, you know, Grant Amen and Matt Moore missing the season. And Ryan Steins, of course, I wrote about him getting drafted. He'll be back at his Utah roots. That'll be really fun to see. Schreiber is the headliner, but what are you looking for in terms of how they integrate him or more big picture, just how they need to attack this Denver Outlaws defense.
Yeah, you know, you basically nailed it with the how do you integrate them. It was, you know, I guess we've seen it this past weekend as well. When you bring someone new back into the fold, it's always a matter of how many shots are going to go to them, how the shots are going to be kind of, you know, reduced amongst others. And, you know, similar sort of thing that we were talking about when you think about Matt Campbell rejoining the Cannons, right? You know, what's it going to take to kind of get him up to speed? You know, game speed versus practice speed, just that whole sort of thing. And do you have the luxury if it, say, takes a quarter to kind of shake some rust off or something like that? Will you, in fact, have that luxury to be able to let him get that rust off in game? You know, I would assume that between Schreiber and Chris Bates and just the organization in general, they're not going to bring him in if he's not totally ready, right? If he's not going to be able to just, I guess, for lack of better terms, just kind of figure it out instantly on the fly that he's good to go. You know, I think they all know what they're doing at this point to a degree that, you know, it's certainly not going to be any sort of mishandling, just, you know, hey, he said he's ready, let's go ahead and try it out or something like that, you know, especially these past few weeks that they've gotten to see him in live action. Obviously, it's just their team and not real games, but they certainly have had that advantage of really getting to watch him practice for a couple weeks now. So I'm sure they'll also have it all figured out as far as, you know, as far as the amount of time he needs to have the ball, you know, touch count on him, pass count on him, just making sure he's integrated very quickly into the offense. But it is something that we haven't seen this year, so very much curious to see how it does pan out.
So you want him, you want first few possessions are going to be key in your mind to get Tom Schreiber to rock and see what he can do right away. And then from there, you can work off what you see.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, we did see it in the Boston game, and I think it's almost natural, right? You know, we've heard somebody like Michael Sowers talk about, you know, like to kind of get into things involved really early. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if they do that, kind of maybe get around once or twice, let Tom get a touch, let him do a dodge, you know, maybe pass, see what he sees out there. You know, I don't think he's going to try to overextend his contribution. Because, I mean, I think what it comes down to with somebody like Tom Schreiber is also, in addition to being really good at lacrosse, he's really smart when it comes to the game. So I don't think he's going to try to overextend himself or kind of, you know, stick his nose where it doesn't belong as far as the entire team offense goes. But I do think it's going to be some sort of, you know, maybe just kind of establish things early so you don't get too caught up in being out there but not really contributing right away.
Mike Manley, great tough matchup for Connor Fields, back down ability, and JT Giles Harris. I like him in that matchup against Sam King. So you look at the rest of the defense there, it's whoever can Paisano hold up against Schreiber. Okay. Are you going to put him on a Ryan Steins instead and maybe let Tarasenko go at him? Start to think the title course, title game collision course might be back on. We'll see. Before we get there, the Eastern Conference semifinal. Well, the Eastern Conference final, really, the PLL's second semifinal, Boston versus Philadelphia. Years of awesome matchups. One of the best rivalries in the game. You know, Boston likes to just throw that first punch against Philadelphia and really rough them up from the first whistle. And whereas Philadelphia's got all this firepower that they're like, what's go at us as much as you like. We'll just pass it to whoever the short stick, Ben Ramsey or Connor Kearse is guarding, Jeff Traynor, and Josh Yago and Kyle Lewis are going to go at them good. So this is going to be really fun. The, you know, I was joking around with people earlier of like, are we going to see Josh Dalt sighting, you know, the former Utah Ute, just written in championship series lore with that vicious cross check on Sowers right to the head, takes him out of the game. Manny Copeland, you know, steps down a couple months later in disgust. So, you know, now that you got this all-time dynamic duo with Sowers and Curse, pretty deserving of co-MVP seasons, all this firepower, Gavin Adler talking his talk on the stick talk, you know, the reigning defensive player of the year. Also, I said that again about Matt Dunn earlier, but, you know, a couple years ago, he was defensive player of the year. Anyways, I digress. Which of those things, if other, are you looking forward to most for Boston Philly?
I mean, to start, just the physical element of these matchups. This is, as much as, and rightfully so, or understandably so, you know, people want to talk about, oh, this is, you know, New York versus Boston. They always do this and that, or New York and Philly. They always do this and that, or East Coast team versus the West Coast, whatever, the Kavanaugh, whatever. This is a track record having beef, you know, like no promotion, no marketing kind of beef. This is a 100% earned beef from a series of skirmishes leading up to this point. And we've seen it time and time again with these two teams. And so I look forward to seeing it again, whatever that means. If it's a clean physical play, then so be it. If there's going to be some testing to see exactly how physical the physical play can be, that's certainly going to be understood as well. I think both teams are going to enter this matchup with that understanding that it is a different sort of animal when the Cannons and Water Dogs play against one another. So we'll see, you know, if anybody gets, I guess, for lack of a better word, pushed around a little bit, or if they both can kind of, you know, step up their game and deliver on that side.
You know, you lay it out perfectly, Rosie. Like, the fans organically hate Brendan O'Neill in Utah, and these two teams organically hate each other due to past history that's been passed on to the younger players who have yet to really take part in all of it has to offer. Two of the weirdest results this season, 19-5, the Water Dogs' first loss of the season, just a 14-goal game that they were never in and really failed to put up a fight in the second half at all, and kind of capitulated there. And then they turn around 17-10, I think the second game of the season was. Didn't really face each other the second half of the season. And we'll see. Two completely different teams here. What did you take? What can you take from the 9-goal Boston display in the quarterfinals that, A, they need to improve on to beat a juggernaut like Philly in the semis, and B, defensively, obviously they can take a lot of positives, but just a different beast when you come up against Philly's firepower.
Right. Yeah, you got to imagine they're coming into this matchup with nothing but confidence on the defensive end. Some fantastic saves from J.C. Higginbotham, and then from the poles that I mentioned earlier, from Donovan and Smith, you know, knowing they've got quite a matchup ahead of them going against Sowers, of course, McCardles of the world. I have to assume they're feeling great about themselves, and I have to assume that they think that a lot of the attention and credit heading into this is going to favor the Water Dogs. So I think that's a position that the Cannons defense loves to be in, kind of as the slept on unit going against the superstar, star-studded, likely award-winning unit that we're going against. So I think they're going to revel in that. And offensively, you know, I think one thing is just kind of a matter of depth. You know, they've had far more productive games than they just had, but you know, seeing Matt Campbell get back into the lineup, I think he had 5 shots, if I'm not mistaken, didn't quite have anything. But, you know, maybe it's another situation, kind of get your legs under you, get the rust shaken off. So certainly feeling good about him moving forward. Two kind of tenets of the Cannons is, you know, if you're hurt, you get right back in there. as we've seen from him, he gets that spot back. And if the shots aren't quite falling, they don't do much to tinker with it or get in your way because they all believe that your shot is going to come back around. So someone like him, he's not really going to, you know, fitting in with the whole Cannon's mantra, certainly not going to back away, especially heading into this matchup against the Water Dogs.
Yeah, Campbell, 0-for-5 shooting. Fregneri had a nice early split dodge on Posey, lefty top shelf. Weissar with that little floater down the alley. He had 1-1. They took out McKelly, who was at times their most consistent midfielder, not really the later stages of the season. Any tinkering that you'd want to see from the midfield or anything?
I don't know if they're going to. I feel like it would be too soon to, you know, as successful as McKelly has been, I feel like if the only other component that could potentially be, you know, restructured is a matter of, say, doing something with Campbell, I don't think that the one game, you know, if you brought him back for one, I think you're definitely going to bring him back for at least two. So I think they'll probably keep things the same, but, you know, I also think that Brian Holman wouldn't be afraid to swap something out at this point in case he does feel like there's some sort of tactical advantage to be gained based on, you know, the composition of the Water Dogs defense.
It is really phenomenal how much the offense flows through Coulter Mackesy. 46 touches, you know, Marcus Holman had 38. Only Chris Cavanaugh had more than Mackesy's with 49 for the Redwoods in that quarterfinal round. So, up against Gavin Adler, it's going to be tough. It's going to be a really fun matchup there. Rosie, give us a lasting thought as we embark on the Zions Bank Stadium in the semifinals.
Lasting thought, something I was thinking about earlier today. So, you got Chris Bates and the Archers, and then you got a bunch of coaches and teams looking to get back there and win the first one. I know the Water Dogs have some titles already, but not in the Tierney era, right? So you're talking about Tierney, Holman. Somebody's trying to get themselves the first PLL title there. So, you know, and Tim Sudan, as we've seen, you know, coming so close in the past, but yeah, not quite getting there as well. So there's a million stories that are going to, you know, be discussed over these next couple of weeks heading into that. But I think one of the big ones I've been focusing on a lot here is how difficult it's been for some of these guys to get past that point and finally reach that championship. So this could be the year for a new one. So it's either a year for a new one or it's a year for the Archers to, I guess, kind of make history and reestablish themselves as a dominant dynasty in the sport.
You know, great way to end the podcast there, Rosie. Could not have said it better myself. If you like what you heard, leave a review, share with a friend, and check back more on InsideLacrosse.com for more PLL coverage from your boys.